This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Food. I'm your host, Kelly Spivey. When I first started baking, I turned to family recipes. I found out that my grandmother's written recipe for banana bread lacked at least one ingredient, and as a result, came out rock hard. It was inedible. So rock hard, it was preserved on a shelf in my kitchen for at least 2 years before I felt it was time to stop my casual scientific experiment. The problem, of course, was that my grandmother knew this recipe. She probably wrote it down at the behest of others, doing her best to remember everything. And I can't blame her for forgetting to write down what her hands instinctively did. Today's guest spent a lifetime learning to cook from the women and sometimes men in her Appalachian family. She is a writer and professor of creative writing in the University of Kentucky's MFA program and has held the honor of being Kentucky's poet laureate from 2021 to 2023. Author of Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts, Stories and Recipes from Five Generations of Black Country Cooks, Crystal Wilkinson is here today. Welcome, Crystal, and thank you for being here.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little about your kitchen ghosts and what drew you to write this book.
I have several generations of kitchen ghosts, the most influential of which is my grandmother. I was raised by my grandmother, and she was a big part of my life. My mother had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia early when I was a child. And so my grandparents raised me. And one of my earliest memories is of me being right up on the stove with my grandmother and stretching as a toddler, trying to see over into the pots because I was too short. So standing in a chair beside her and stretching over into the pots. So she's my primary kitchen ghost. And I came to that terminology when, you know, as poets will, during a time of deep grief, my grandmother had passed away, and I was cooking my first holiday meal without her. We'd always gathered at my grandparents' house for all the holidays, you know, seven kids, 25 plus grandchildren, several great greats. And I just couldn't get through the meal. You know, I kept crying, couldn't get through it. And I remembered that I had her dress, and I went into the closet back here at the house and got her dress and brought it in with me kind of out of desperation. I don't know why I did that, but I did, and took it into the kitchen and felt her presence right there with me and felt like she was right there. So that's where the term came from. Kitchen ghost. And I didn't even plan on writing about it. You know, I just thought I would, it was a term, I would keep it near and dear. And having her spirit there with me enabled me to get through that first Thanksgiving. And, you know, run along years later, I used it in some fiction, I used it in poetry. And then here comes this book, and I used it in that way.
Yeah, the book is really beautiful in a lot of ways, physically and also in the stories that are in there. It actually reminds me a little of Edna Lewis's The Taste of Country Cooking, where she has like recipes, but there's stories. It just kind of like goes in and out of these different genres in a really beautiful way. And you use, you know, memoir and fiction, and it is a practical cookbook. I made the hot milk cake, which I guess I'll go ahead and not be ashamed that I had it for breakfast this morning, but here we are. So the recipes are excellent, but I do want to know, as a writer, how do you look at cookbooks and recipes? Do you see them as kind of texts? Do you see them as stories? Can you tell me a little bit about how you incorporated recipes into these stories and vice versa?
Yeah, you know, I originally thought that this book would be all words, and the recipes were there to supplement the stories about my family using food as the lens. And I thought that I've always thought of as recipes as being almost like poems, especially the way that recipes are handed down in our families, especially in Appalachian families and Black families. It's like, I hear so many people talking about this, like you can't get anything out of these brilliant cooks that we have. And so it doesn't come out in a formal way. It comes out like, you know, reach down there and get that blue bowl, and you're going to feel that blue bowl about halfway, and then take a dab of this and a pinch of that. And that's kind of how my grandmother always sort of, if I ask her about the story of a particular food, which is my way of asking her, how do you make this? It was never straight out, you know, you're going to get you a half a cup of this, or rarely. So I thought of them as both oral, you know, from the oral tradition, and also aural, as in listening. Like it was as much a part of listening and watching was as much a part of it as anything that was written down. And so that's how I thought of them as poems, almost coming straight from the voice instead of being written down. Although I did have a lot of recipes written down, you know, I've always been sort of the storyteller in the family, or the person who sort of gathers things and takes notes. And so I do remember, I should have brought it in here to show you, but I've got my original recipe box from when I was probably 14, maybe younger. Well, probably 12 or 13, because I graduated from high school when I was 16. And I would, in my first home ec class, one of our assignments, our primary assignment, was to get a metal recipe box that had the titles in it, you know, cakes, pies, whatever they all were. And we were supposed to fill that up, was our assignment for the semester, or for the year in the home ec class. And so some of those, almost all of them, are dictated, where I said, you know, okay, Granny, tell me about the hot milk cake, or tell me about cornbread, or tell me about corn pudding, or whatever it was, and I just write them down. So I wanted those to stay that sort of colloquial way inside the stories, with the stories coming first. You know, I called it a collection of essays, is what I originally called it. And then Frances Lamb was my editor, and Frances said, well, you know, we want people to be able to cook from this. And I said, well, they can. And then I said that was sort of an inflection at the end, knowing good and well that they really couldn't unless they called me, because it was full of dabs and bits and, you know, till it looks right and those kind of things. And so it was kind of a nice project to then turn them into like usable recipes for people, and to work with Bonnie Benwick, who was the food tester, to turn them into sort of contemporary recipes in that way. But I've always thought of recipes as part of storytelling.
That's really beautiful. The other question that I wanted to ask, kind of along a similar line of telling stories, you've given a voice to your ancestors in this book, many of whom did not have that luxury in life. How do you see the role of fiction in a memoir or in stories about food?
I almost hesitate at the word fiction because and it is true that I, as a novelist, as a short story writer, use the tools that are available to me to be able to tell the story about ancestors that I don't know about. One of the most daunting things about doing the research was sort of the legacy of slavery that we all have inherited, and the fact that, as a woman, as a Black woman, finding my people meant, one, I felt privileged that I was able to find anything about Aggie, considering that she's my fourth great grandmother, that she was enslaved and then freed by my fourth great grandfather. So privileged to find her on the page, but then to realize that there's nothing before she was brought to Kentucky. And then when Tarleton, my fourth great grandfather, again, who was white, dies, then I lose trace of her again. So she's my ancestor, our ancestor in my family, but she became sort of a stand-in for women, period, whose stories aren't told or haven't been told because they weren't connected with the right man, and their stories weren't valued, but also Black women and the tens of thousands of Black women who we don't know who their mothers are or what their real names were before they were given the name of that particular ancestor. So it even knowing the history and having been an academic and having studied the history, it sort of turned something in me to be able to reclaim her history. And I say her, but their history, because there are several people in the book that I allow to step forward and tell their own story. And then that's kind of given agency to people, women again, who didn't have agency in their lives. Or not very much agency in their lives to, it's almost an activist act to allow my fourth great grandmother, who was enslaved, to step forward on the stage of this book to deliver her own story. And the same with, Ma Lily and even my grandmother, who was more contemporary, but got married at 14. And like many women of her time, lost their girlhoods to duty and responsibility. And my grandfather's voice was the primary one. Hers was secondary, even though she was more educated than him. Had a creative spirit, and he was a kind, gentle man, but also a man of his time. Like, he was the head of the household. She ran around in circles serving him and making sure his glass was full of tea or milk or whatever he was drinking, and make sure she served him his second helpings or make sure he had pie or whatever it was, and took care of the children and slopped the hogs and milked the cows and tended the garden. So, using the tools available to me as a fiction writer to allow those women to tell their own stories, I thought was an act of agency, an act of empowerment for them.
Yeah, it really allows them to be their own person and not just exist in relation to, in relation to a man or a farm or a place or whatever. Like they have their own stories and their own lives. Tell me a little bit about Indian Creek and growing up there, because I think a lot of times, you do mention this in the book, speaking of Frank X. Walker and the Appalachian poets. When people think of Appalachia, there's a very specific image that comes to mind. That is not correct all the time. There's so many more stories and people in that area. Can you just tell me a little bit about growing up in Appalachia?
I mean, and a lot of people, I think a lot of Black people sort of reject the notion of Appalachia because of the stereotype, really, of the Appalachian stereotype. It's like, okay, I have enough to deal with without adding this on top of it. But I'm proud to be from the area that I'm from. And you know, Indian Creek was a little, at least more Black. It wasn't all Black, but at one point there were a lot of Black people that lived on Indian Creek. And I grew up in that little community when the county that I grew up in was probably, back then, I'd say it was 85 to 90% white, but there was this little insular, mostly related to each other, enclave of Black people who'd been there for years, hundreds of years, and that's where I grew up. And I grew up with my grandparents, and I was able to sort of roam free on that farm, 64 acres. We lived off of the main road onto a gravel road, sort of back up a holler a little bit. And when I was a little girl, we used to have to drive. You know, a friend of mine had a saying, like, the road was mostly in the creek. And when I was a little girl, the road was in the creek. You had to drive through the creek to get home. But I think that freedom to roam around and talk to the animals and be sort of free out in nature is what made my imagination expand. And that's why I'm a writer. My grandfather was a tobacco farmer and had a few head of cattle and was a milk farmer at some point. He made sorghum. My grandmother was a domestic worker for primarily for school teachers, white school teachers in town. And they were all my teachers. And between my grandmother and those teachers, I think that's what instilled the love of reading for me. And we went to a one-room Black church that was right on the Case County, Lincoln County line. And church was really connected to food, or food was connected to church, both. when I was young, we had those huge basket meetings and what some people call dinner on the grounds, where the church would provide the meat and they'd provide chickens to every home. And once again, the women had to fry those chickens, and then they'd provide mutton to each home to be cooked. And then we would carry all that food in the car to the church, and people would come from miles around, and anybody who was from that area would come back home on that Sunday. And, you know, church was had, music was played, songs were sung, but food was eaten in big, big ways. People would talk about that more than the preaching or anything else that was going on, like that they couldn't wait to get home to taste that caramel cake or that blackberry cobbler or whatever it was that was their favorites. And so I think my childhood was very, in some ways, very insular, because I was my mother's only child. And by the time my grandparents raised me, all the kids were gone. So there was a lot of solitude and a lot of loneliness, which I think fostered my imagination. But there was also a lot of community there with the people on Indian Creek and also with the family and the community there.
What do you remember about your grandmother's house? Are there any like smells that come to mind or textures?
Well, there was always something on the stove, right? It was the kind of house that, I don't know how they did it, because it wasn't just my grandmother. A lot of women lived this way, but you know, all the work that had to be done during a day, like you think about the way that we lived, and really I'm at least one generation removed because I was grandparents raised. I really grew up in ways that were more akin to my mother's time and my father's time than my generation, but we didn't have running water. And so even something as simple that we take for granted, like going to the bathroom, was different. And so doing all of that and, you know, having to get up and start the day by going to the well to get water, And then to cook all day long, to have three huge meals a day. So what I mostly remember is the smell of food. Like, it's one of my primary memories is the smell of food. You know, another one is if we're talking about the senses, all the smells of summer. So the smell and taste of the perfect ripe tomato. There's nothing like that.
I just smelled, I have like this love of the smell of tomato leaves, like the leaves of the plant. I just love the way that smells. And
yeah,
anytime anybody talks about a ripe tomato, that's the first I can smell it. And it just is right there.
Nothing like it. Nothing like it. And, you know, and I do little things like I'm late this year, but I take little starter cups and put tomato seeds in them and grow my own. I have to skip all those steps this year because I have not done any of it. But just have that smell in my house of those budding tomato leaves, like nothing smells like that. And then you just know that tomato is coming. You know, if in my case, the raccoons and the groundhogs don't eat them and the squirrels. But I remember the strong smell of real food that you can't get in a grocery store. So tomatoes is one. Squash has its own smell. And then any other sort of main thing that was cooking, there was always something on the stove cooking, whether it was something that I considered foul, like, you know, there was always a head of a pig, you know, half the time on the stove when she was making souse. Or the smell of chili or chicken and dumplings and all beans, you know, a big pot of soup beans and cornbread. So being able to identify, you know, I think a lot of people can't even identify foods, like the smells of food. Like, what's that smell? Oh, that's bread. Well, what kind of bread is it? Oh, that smells like rolls. You can smell the yeast. Or that smells like biscuits. Or cornbread has its own smell. And so those, I remember those smells. And I remember being young and being able to identify them. You know, if my grandmother was fixing flapjacks, you would smell like a little bit of sweetness in the bread. If she was fixing biscuits, you could smell what that smelled like. You knew what cornbread, the wonderful smell of cornbread, which is one of my favorite ones. So yeah, that's one of the things I remember, all those wonderful smells and sounds.
Did you start cooking with your grandmother out of an interest for cooking, or did you just want to be where the action was happening?
I think I wanted to be close to her, but I was always fascinated with the kitchen, and probably because of her, because I was always right at her skirt tail. But I did find it fascinating, and more fascinating than I wasn't the kind of, and I think because I was a bookish girl, you know, I really loved reading, which I would bring my books into the kitchen too. I was never much of an outside person, even though we were outside a lot. I loved being in the house and sort of nesting in the kitchen. And so it was never a thing where Granny said, you know, well, I'm going to teach you how to cook today. Like I say in the book, I just learned by sight, just by watching mostly, because I also don't come from a talkative people. So there wasn't a lot like, I'm going to give you your lesson today. I mean, he hadn't said, you know, there was none of that. It was just, she was doing what she needed to do and I was watching her do it. So I did enjoy, and I was also very spoiled. I was spoiled rotten. So I learned how to cook because I wanted to. It took me well into my adulthood to learn how to do other things. I went to college not knowing how to wash my clothes and iron them, or, you know, some of the other chores you would have thought that I learned. But I could certainly cook a meal for my entire dorm floor. I could do that as long as somebody else did the cleanup, because I didn't really know how. I didn't do it very efficiently.
I mean, that's all. Knowing how to cook is such a gift, just for yourself and for obviously the people around you, I'm sure.
also find it very meditative. You know, I see it. Like, I know people, you know, and I've met people along this journey with Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts as I've gone around who say, well, you know, my family, either their families imposed it upon them or they imposed it upon themselves, that they saw cooking as drudgery for women. And so they decided not to do it because they wanted to go to college. Well, I managed to do both. And I get sad sometimes when I don't have time to cook because, you know, I am a division director in our department, and I'm doing speaking engagements and doing all these things. But sometimes I find making homemade bread and kneading bread or making a pone of cornbread or doing something. One, I think it returns me to my roots. There's always this saying in Appalachian families about not getting above your raisin. So I think there's that too, of like feeling like I need to do something that my grandmother did to sort of ground myself. But there's also something meditative about it. There's something meditative about the way kitchen light is, the way light comes through the window when you're making a cake, or the rhythms of kneading bread. I find it all very meditative too.
I mean, you can hear the poetry in it as you're talking about it. I too come from a line of farmers. You know, they had gardens, and I sort of had a foot in both worlds, where, you know, I had my like Game Boy, but I was also really interested in this like sour cherry tree that my grandmother had. And I was trying to get to the cherries before the birds did every year, and I failed miserably most of the time. But I loved all the instances of foraging that you talk about in the book, with blackberries and, you know, wild greens, which I don't know if people know that poke is poisonous or not.
I don't think they do. Somebody said something about, I was so horrified the other day, met a woman and she said, well, my husband is experimenting. And she gave me like a little thing of, they had made biscuits at this bookstore that I went to. And I met a woman, she had made, her husband had made lavender jelly, homemade. And I thought, oh, that's great. And she said, well, he wants to make elderberry jelly. And she said, but he doesn't know where to find elderberries. And she said he went out and brought these things home one year, and it was pokeberries. And I was like, oh my God, like, it's going to kill the whole bunch. Like, that's just... So I worry about people. I would even worry about myself just going roaming around. But I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, and people have died. I mean, I'm laughing because it's kind of crazy, but people have died because they think they know what they're doing and they ended up not knowing what they're doing, or they get really sick. So yeah, people don't realize that poke is poisonous, and a lot of those wild things are.
Yeah, I mean, cassava, if you don't process it right, has cyanide in it.
Yeah.
You know, like there are, but these are, I think, calls back to what you were saying earlier. These are in part oral traditions. You are being told these things, and it's information that you have that is powerful.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned blackberries being sold as a way of making income, and, you know, foraging wild greens as a way of putting food on the table. So much of it is about necessity, but it doesn't feel that way when you eat it.
Right.
And I think, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that I think is fascinating to me, is that almost all of our, you know, a generation or two ago, the foods that we love so much, that's our comfort foods now, was struggle foods or survival foods for our ancestors. You know, like foraging for for greens was a necessity, especially in the hills and mountains, because, you know, you often went through these bad winters where there was scarcity of food. And so when spring came, it was time to go out into the woods and get those first sprouts of whatever you could find. And that's also why you can eat polk if you get it early, like after, Lord have mercy, after it's already grown up and gotten more and more poisonous with every inch it grows. Like, that's not when you're supposed to eat it. But and you have to blanch it. Like, there's a whole process of doing this and pour the toxins off of it. And a lot of wild greens are like that. But, you know, you think about, not only were they hungry, they were also malnutritioned by the time those springs came. And so having some kind of green that you can put into your body as a tonic to get some nutrients back in your body was important too. And yeah, it's kind of fun for us. Like, we live in that time of plenty. Like, there's people that do these throwback things and for nostalgia's sake or for recreation, but that was not the case in the time of our ancestors.
Yeah, I think it's so easy to forget how we got food. Mm-hmm. You know, we're so used to grocery stores, or, I mean, at this point, goodness, you can order things and have it delivered to your house. Like, the idea that you would have to go out and not just pick something up that you could then go home and eat, but harvest it and prep it and cook it.
Yeah.
And just,
yeah, I felt so privileged and so snobby when I ordered dandelion greens from the Whole Foods as an experiment. And I was like, oh Lord, that's not how it's supposed to be.
I went to like four different grocery stores trying to find sorghum here in Colorado, and I don't think they have a clue what it is. I have not been able to find. I think I'm just going to have to order it.
You have to order it. Order it online. Order it from I get mine from the Amish folks from down home. They're the ones that make it closest to what my grandfather made. And
I know. I love that chapter. I love that chapter with your grandfather, the sorghum king.
Uh-huh.
And just hearing, as I feel like I've heard him, you know, taste things and say, like, you know, they didn't do this or they didn't do that. Like, just knowing, just having that bodily knowledge is so hard to find, I feel like, anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is hard to find. You know, I feel like that I am so interested and so sort of hungry for that way of life. I don't know if I'm being correct, but I know what my memory remembers. So I find myself stepping into my grandfather's shoes when I do buy sorghum. I'm like, this is a little overcooked. This tastes a little, I think it was a little green when it was when it was cooked, because he always had those sort of critiques when he was, and even of his own, when he was making sorghum, he always had these critiques like, I think I overcooked it a little bit, or I need to let it cook some more. And it's just such a master chemist too at it, for someone who had a third grade education. Like, he was the precision levels of how this needed to be done was always so fascinating and amazing to me.
I mean, there's a lot to be said for that hands-on experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you write in the book that cooking is in the body. And I baked for a really long time, and people love to say that baking is science. But for me, it's feel, it's doing it enough times that you just know when it's right. You know, you can smell when it's ready, things like that. I think that people are really eager to take that out, because then if cooking is just a list of ingredients, you know, it's how can I screw this up? You know?
Right. And sometimes they do. Yeah, you know, I was talking to somebody about that the other day when I was I went to visit Princeton's campus, and people were talking about their, it was at dinner, and they were talking about like how they cannot, there's all kinds of reasons I believe that we cannot cook like our mamas and like our grandmothers and like our granddaddies or whoever we're trying to cook. One is the ingredients. Two is like the intuitive part. You know, like I think about the ingredients that I mean, like our ancestors were the original farm to table. So even if you gathered all the ingredients and you got the lard and the flour and the whatever, it's not going to be the same as being able to have lard from a pig that's from a few yards away from your house. It's not the same as going to the Whole Foods and getting it. It's the same. The dandelion greens are not going to taste the same picked alongside the road as ordering them from a Whole Foods market. And I think some of it is about memory and how we revere the people who cook the food. And it's like, oh, that's not it. That's not quite it. I can't do it as good as she did. But I think the other one is that we've lost sight of that intuition. You know, someone else was talking about her and her sister calling their auntie to try to get her to tell them how to make this particular dish. And the aunt, their mother has passed, and the auntie finally just hung up on them because she kept saying, till it looks right. You do that till it looks right. And they kept saying, but what's the look right? Like what, how much? And she just finally just hung up because it was just not gonna work. But I think we forget about that. Like we think that there's magic in, you know, I don't know how many times like young people, even in my own family, or people have said, well, you know, I tried to do this, but it didn't turn out right. Sometimes it's in the intuition. Like you said, you know, like even if you use a recipe and, you know, you can pick up your biscuit dough with a spoon and it's fallen off the spoon, then it's not the right texture. Like even whatever the recipe said, you need to add some more flour. Like you have to, and it's in the body and in the knowing, and you do that by sight. Like you can't, whatever it says, if it said just 2 cups, you're going to need more than 2 cups because you can't make biscuits out of that. Like you just have to know.
No fear.
Yes. Yeah. You got to be able to be in the kitchen enough to have some intuition about ingredients and about the formula. It is science, but not just science.
Thank you for validating that for me. You also talk about Sunday dinners, and there's so much joy in that chapter for me. It's like coming off the page of like the comfort and the joy of making a Sunday dinner. What does cooking in general mean to you?
You know, I think it's a form of reverence. It's like I said, it's meditation. It's also a form of love. You know, I've often said that I think if some of our leaders, you know, all the problems that we have in the world, that if people could sit down at a table and have a good meal while they're talking about it, those things could be large and small, could be resolved, because it's, you know, it's something, of course, that we need. But food and sharing of food, breaking bread together, I think is one of the great joys in life, to be able to have a conversation over a meal. Or whatever you're doing, spending time with your family. Like I know in modern times, and even in my small household with me and my husband, sometimes we'll have a good bowl of something and we're actually not talking, we're watching television, but it's still an act of intimacy, an act of love that I have poured into the meal. And there's great joy, I think. There's great joy in eating. It's such a communal act. Even when you go to a restaurant, a lot of people take that for granted. But somebody is working hard back there to get this. And even before that, someone had to harvest all of these things or kill this animal and prep this food in order for it to get to your table.
Yeah, it's a means of connection.
Yeah, it's a means of connection. It's if it's good, of course there's satisfaction is the end result, but it's even more than that, I think. Buddhas are like a great unifier. And in any given meal, there's so many things that have happened for this meal to come together.
Yeah. Is there anything in the book? I know we kind of went all over the place. Was there anything that I didn't really touch on, or anything that you really want to make sure people know about the book?
I mean, I think what's been interesting to me is that some people who love cookbooks have said, there's too many words in this There's too many words. There's only 40 recipes, too much narrative. But I think that that's one of the things that makes it unique. It's not completely unheard of. There's lots of books that we all know about and love and have read that do something similar. But I think that the melding of the recipes and the stories, that was important to me, the melding of those. And I think that the specificity of it makes it even more universal. One of the things that I think I said this earlier, but one of the things that hit me right away at my first event, I went across country on book tour and had over 20 cities that I stopped in. And in almost all of them, we were all in tears because it's a universal concept. My Black Appalachian grandmother, who was 4'11" and swore she was 5 foot tall, was my kitchen ghost. Someone else's Italian Nona was their kitchen ghost. It's a universal concept. We miss the people that we love who have passed away, and we miss the way that they did things. So people of all hues and all walks of life that I've met along the way, that has been the one sort of unifying thing that without fail, every event that I had, people would say, I'm going to go home and make this because reading this book or hearing you talk about this book has reminded me of my mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, my aunt, etc. So some kitchen ghosts that they've been able to reach out and commune with. It makes us all one, and it makes us all more human to have that common experience.
And go ahead and reach out to all of your people before they become your kitchen ghosts.
That's true. Yes, don't wait.
Let them show you some things because so much of it is just not written down.
Yeah, and people ask me, well, how can I, my grandmother won't give us the recipes. And I say, well, stop asking for the recipes and ask for a story.
I was about to say she probably doesn't have a recipe to give you.
Right. But I mean, I think that if you ask for the story of it, like instead of saying, I want the recipe for black, like tell me how long have you been cooking this? Tell me a story about this. We have this every year. Tell me a story about it. And then you'll get something like, well, I learned how to make it when.
And then you get your family history.
Yeah.
What do you think Aggie would say about this book?
I think that she, each one, I think, of the matriarchs in the book had a different desire or a different want. But I think hers was her primary one was agency. Like she wanted to have some say so. So I think she would be pleased that she gets to step forward and speak.
I think so too. Well, thank you so much for spending some time talking about your family and your food. And it's just been really wonderful. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.